Into the final moments, Alex Payne trying to keep this side going forward. Haskell takes it on now with just relentless chat, largely about himself. And there's Tindall to add the finishing touch of glamour and World Cup winning stories and a slightly sideways nose. That is how you podcast. A dominant display by the good, the bad and the rugby.
Hello, Dream Team. Welcome along once again to Season 3, Episode 10 of The Good, The Bad and The Rugby. 10 in already. Time flies when you're having fun, apparently. I'm not quite sure how much fun there is around the game at the moment. That's a question we'll get into on this week's show. What a week it has been, though, in the tumultuous world of rugby union. Firstly, and most importantly, the desperately sad news around the passing of the incredible Doddy Weir. Incredible tributes, a great man of the game, £8 million raised for the My Name's Doddy Foundation, and someone really who has reminded us all of what the rugby values are all about. We're going to talk to his old mucker, his old teammate, Kenny Logan, a bit later on to get the load on the big man. Desperately sad news, but what a legacy and what memories and what stories Doddy Weir leaves behind. And if that, I suppose, is something to warm the cockles and to remind us all what rugby is all about, we've seen the flip side this week in the aftermath of a desperately disappointing defeat for England at Twickenham. Interesting, the same people tweeting their love for Doddy have had a lot to say as well about Eddie Jones. Should he stay or should he go? Where are England off the back of a tough ride against the box? And of course, he's not the only one feeling the heat right now. Wayne Pivac has copped a whole load off the back of Wales' late collapse to the Wallabies. Ellis Genge is going to join us to give us the player's view from inside the England camp. And elsewhere, the game hasn't exactly covered itself in glory either, as Wayne Barnes had his 100th test celebration as an international referee cancelled at Twickenham because of the fears over the reception that he was going to receive at Twickenham. What does that tell you right now? I don't know. As we said, a little hard at times to find the fun in rugby as things stand. Tins, though, is out of the woods. He may or he may not dial in. He said he might, but where he is right now, it's 4 a.m. and he told us he was out for
a boozy dinner. Yeah.
So let's not have hopes too high on that. We'll catch up with him, hopefully, on this show, and if not, in due course. Shall we set our stall out there? Because we've had a lot of people challenging us this week saying, I hope you're going to say it as you see it. And I think we'll do that. I think we normally do. Yeah. I think we probably are in amongst the rare breed of Eddie Jones backers. You love him. You played your best rugby under him. I've always found him a very engaging interviewee. And I think we've got a couple of things that we can discuss in all of this. But
I reckon I just need to break a real confession here.
Okay.
I know I always joke on the pod like I don't watch rugby. I obviously do. I read all the news. Like I'm au fait with everything. I just play up to that caricature because I know people always criticise. You don't watch the fucking rugby. I got very drunk on Saturday.
At Twickenham.
I watched a bit of it.
I think a lot of people at Twickenham felt quite similar and did very similar.
Look, I mean, obviously they're just not good enough. Like I don't really know what else I can say. You know, like people always blame the coach. Coach doesn't take to the field. Players take to the field. You know, how many players have stood up in this autumn international and played really well for England? Who thought remarkable? Who would you swap if you were going to do a team of the autumn? Who would make it in from the England team? You know, the idea and concept is that Eddie Jones is coaching the team not to play well. Why the fuck would he do that? Like, why ask yourself, why would he coach himself? So either he's suddenly become a bad coach overnight and lost the plot and just decided to coach England into the ground, which he hasn't. Why would he want to not treat his players properly because you want a motivated side? Like, all the things that are labelled against him are just so illogical. It makes no sense.
Yeah,
I just don't think they're playing particularly well. I think international rugby is very close. I think it's fucking boring. It's not that
interesting.
As a product.
33 minutes ball in play at Twickenham on Saturday. £400 to have a day out.
I was working in the library. I got free piss with this. I was happy.
Okay, let's try and peel back one or two more layers beyond that. Because there is a lot to talk about. Yeah. And there is a lot to kind of look at and a lot to kind of assess. As I said, we are the rare breed of Eddie Jones backers. There aren't many of them around right now. We're certainly sitting a little bit in isolation. You said a couple of weeks ago that you did an event and there was an extraordinary amount of anti-Eddie sentiment.
Yes, it's everywhere.
And I think that's obviously making things very difficult for him and probably for the team as well. Have we reached the point now where it's gone too far? Or do you think, knowing the man as you do and knowing the credentials in the game, his credentials in the game, that it is retrievable, repairable and rebuildable?
The honest answer is yes, I do. If you're not overtly negative, right, and really sceptical and scathing in sports commentary and sports analysis in this country, you're obviously not saying it how it is. You always have to be slagging people. You always have to say everything's shit. You always have to say they're awful, get rid of them. I mean, everywhere I go now, every dinner I do, and I've spoken at a dinner lunch every single day for the last 3 weeks, all over the place. All I want to know about is Eddie Jones. Everyone's very scathing. Everyone understands. I mean, he took England to a World Cup final. His win record, I think, is...
Can I give you the stats? Because yes. I've actually done the work on this. So this is England's current head coach. I'm glad one of us has. He has won the six, since he's become England head coach, he's won the Six Nations 3 years in seven. He has won a Grand Slam, two titles and two Triple Crowns. He's taken England to a World Cup final. In 2016 and 2017, he produced a record-equaling run of Test victories in the men's game. He's had two series wins in Australia. And as far as the World Cup is concerned, he's been to four of them. He's won one as assistant coach with South Africa, two runners-up medals as head coach of Australia and head coach of England, and in charge of Japan, he was the first team to win three of the four pool games. They didn't make it through, but they did beat South Africa. So what I would suggest from that is that he's got a huge amount of pedigree when it comes to tournament rugby, and I think the landscape will change immeasurably as we get towards the Rugby World Cup. And actually, he has delivered for England, albeit not recently. And I think that's the problem, is that the last 2 years have been very poor. 41% win ratio this year, five wins in 12. Just as an aside, France obviously won this year's Grand Slam, Six Nations. Last year's champions were Wales, and the year before that was England.
Yes.
So the two head coaches whose heads are on the block right now have won the title in the last 3 years.
Yes.
Those are the facts. You can rip them up and you can recut them and you can talk about all you want in terms of not being where they want to be right now, but he has got pedigree, he knows what he's doing, etc. So come back to the question, you were about to go through it all. Has it gone too far? Has the elastic band gone beyond retraction?
No, because I don't think it has, because ultimately if you just ignore the media and fans, you just carry on with your job. I don't see him as a quitter. I think, you know, there's obviously... They'll do some review. Everyone said in the newspapers today that, you know, they're having an autumn review and they're disappointed. Everyone's disappointed. The players will be disappointed. I always think you have to look first at the players and then have to ask the players what they think first and foremost, because I'm not in the squad anymore, right? But everyone I speak to, you know, if you were to ask me about coaches I had at England, we would tell you how shit they were. We'd call you up and go, fucking hell, you won't believe what so-and-so's done. You won't believe so-and-so. Oh my God, we trained for 3 hours the other day. We ran 18K on our first day. Or someone said this to someone. Like, you would tell people. Nobody's saying that from within the camp. Nobody believes that. And I think, I just don't see the logic behind why he would not coach people as he'd want to and what he's doing that isn't right. And yet, look, he has his faults. You know, I've got more faults than anyone. I'm not really keen to pass judgment on people and fans. All I want to do is deal with what I think would be best for England. I don't think there is a better coach to take England to a World Cup than Eddie Jones. People talk about Warren Gatland. You know, Warren Gatland specialises in taking a team in a short period of time and getting them over the line. You know, if for some reason the RFU were to lose their heads and get rid of him, which I don't think is the right thing to do, he can nearly do it. But has Warren Gatland ever got anyone to a World Cup final? No. But equally, you know, Eddie came and turned a side that Stuart Lancaster couldn't get out the pool stage of the own home World Cup 2015, 6 months later changed them into a Grand Slam winning side and essentially a World Cup losing side, but in a final. Maybe Warren could come in and do that and to take that same pool of talent, because I don't think there's any problem with talent. I just don't think they're playing very well, and I just don't think it's got anything to do with what the coach is doing. I just don't see. I think they're motivated. I think they're looked after. I think the settings are good. My only criticism ever... I've been with Eddie. Well, over Eddie would be the consistency of coaching staff around him, because you need some consistency.
So I would leverage that the absence of Steve Borthwick and Scott Weismantle has been very hard to replicate or replace.
I agree, because you know Eddie's success when I was playing and under that team was because the balance of the coaching staff were very good. You had the right balance. You had Steve Borthwick, who, you know, he was almost an unsung hero. He's incredible. They worked very well with Eddie, who no one worked harder than Steve. You then had, obviously, Paul Gustard originally, who was utterly fantastic. Then you had Weismantle come in. You had John Mitchell. You had guys there. I'm not saying the other coaches aren't doing well, but I'm saying you want some consistency. And again, there's going to be some changes. Consistency over selection. I think sometimes his hand's been forced. Sometimes he's been trying things. It hasn't worked. I still don't see why he would have to take responsibility when it's the players taking the field and the players just aren't playing well. Now, why are they not playing well? That's what you ask yourself. That's all that matters. Not what he's coaching. Why are they not playing well? Are they overtraining? I don't know. What is it they're doing that's not helping them? What's not, because when it was under other coaches in England, it was because the emotional intelligence wasn't right. The training wasn't right. The game plan wasn't right. Things didn't suit the players. Eddie Jones isn't on the field to lose, only get 3 out of 7 scrums right. Eddie Jones isn't on the field to win 6 out of 9 lineouts. I mean, they're set piece moves. Like, how are you going to win a game against Africa with set piece, your shit house? Like, you can't. So what's Eddie Jones? What's he got to do with that set piece? It's because the fucker didn't get the set piece right. They got beasted off the field. And that's how it happens sometimes in international rugby. But I don't know what everyone wants to burn everything down. I just don't see a better man to do the job than him. But if the players come out, I mean, the answer is the players got to come out. If they get asked and they say, do you know what, it's awful. You know, we don't know where we stand. It's all over the place. It's fine, but I just don't think that's going to happen.
Let me throw you some bits that I've picked out online then. So Al Eakin, who commentates on BT Sports, says that he has heard off-the-record testimonies of unhappy experiences in camp. Now, you speak to the current players a lot. We speak to them a fair amount.
Yeah.
I've not heard anybody say that. In fact, we had Jack Noel on the other day who said completely the opposite.
Think what it is.
There's
always going to be people who have bad experiences.
So I think that's bad.
Because look, out of the 5 coaches I had, I got on with all of them, but one of them got me.
Yep.
But there were plenty of other players amongst the other four who got them who Eddie didn't get.
Yep.
And vice versa. Everyone has a relationship. I mean, out of sheer statistics, I was bound to get on with one of them and they were about to get the right thing out of me. I mean, unless I'm, a problem. There's always going to be players he does things wrong.
So I think even if you look at that 2003 squad, you'd have found a number of players on the fringes. Austin Healey, not picked. Simon Shaw, not picked, then picked Millie to hold tackle. And if they'd lost that 2003 squad, Jesus Christ, the repercussions would have gone on for decades.
Show you any workplace, any environment, any team, any teacher-pupil relationship, any boss relationship, it's always someone who's unhappy with something, right? Always, because, and look, when you're dealing with coaching and human interaction, you're bound to get it wrong. Like, how many times have you, with your kid, you had a stress thing, lost your temper with your kid and then felt awful afterwards, or not even noticed it, and your child gets upset with it? It's the same thing. How many times has someone caught you unaware then and you've told them, well, fuck off, and they're not realised? I'm sure there's lots of cases that I just don't understand the rationale why he's apparently changed into some absolute nightmare. And all the people who want to fire him are just, they're not really criticising the players, they're just going after him. And I love the players, I just think it's a case of just not playing very well. And I don't think we're a million miles away from it. I just think it might be a confidence thing, might be a couple of tweaks in positional play, might be, some more consistency of the side playing together, might be a wake-up call that they needed. Because, again, the team that lost in the Six Nations is different from the team that started now. So, I don't know.
I can already feel the reaction that this is going to provoke, because we're not quite saying Eddie must go, which I think is the groundswell of things.
Well, okay, fine, Eddie must go. Fuck it, go on, get rid of him. I don't understand, having been there, I just don't think.
So, okay, let me rephrase this then. You have been in environments where the coach, you have known that the coach's time is done.
Yes.
So Di Young with Wasps,
yes.
Stuart Lancaster with England, it was sort of inevitable. You could probably name me 2 or 3 others. What is that environment like as a player when you know that the guy leading it is basically on his way out?
Well, not great, because
do you feel responsible, guilty, upset?
Well, normally,
have you ever been part of getting rid of the coach?
No, I've never been. No, because even in 2011, so 2011, when the Martin Johnson thing happened, they asked me to take part in that review, and I refused. I told the RFU to fuck off. I said, I'm not taking part. I've got bigger problems to worry about than slagging people off. I didn't do it. 2015, they called me up and I had a conversation with someone. And this is the truth. I literally said, they're all great coaches. I really like them. I'm not sure about quite how the kind of the people focus over the task. I thought it was quite task focused over people. I said that, but I said, great guys that couldn't. That we were as fit. We were fitter than we've ever been. That's how stupid it is, and it's what really upsets me. So 2015, we got thrown out of the World Cup.
You were too fit, weren't you? Everybody, you went too lightweight.
Everyone says we were unfit. So every expert, even Eddie, said this, right? Eddie, and I've never had the heart to tell Eddie this, but we were the fittest we've ever been. Maybe not fit the way we wanted to play, but we were fit. We ran ourselves into the ground. It's physically impossible for us not to be fit. We were breaking records. So all the journalists, all these experts, all these media people said, you're unfit. Fucking bollocks. Sam Peters said we're unfit. All of them said we're unfit. Alex Spinks said we're all unfit. And we're not, nothing to do with unfit. We picked the wrong players. We didn't get the right game plan. We didn't play a game that was a tournament. It wasn't do or die. It was always talking about the next World Cup, and that's where we went wrong. And the team wasn't enough camaraderie. There was too many vanilla thrillers in the side, and we didn't. And the veneer of team spirit was too thin. That's it, right? Eddie came in, changed that, and changed the way we play, changed the directness, focused on different areas of fitness, changed our physicality.
How much nasty did Eddie put in that squad?
Very nasty.
I wonder whether that is something that isn't there now. So, and the reason I say that, Lawrence Dallaglio, I'm not sure the players have the heart or the head.
See, I just, again, look, because a lot of my former teammates, you know, and again, I don't see it's as dire as everybody says it is. I just think, you know, I've been involved in sides that it only takes a few things to change and to have a real big reflection period on it. And I think, you know, we're not far out for the World Cup now. You know, it's pretty much do or die. And a lot of guys, a lot of those players take the field and have a long, hard look at themselves. And you've got to ask yourself, which players, you know, put themselves with glory? I don't think a lot of them did. And they all know that. And it doesn't need me to tell them they don't know. I mean, I can't even run upstairs anymore. So I'm not in a position to criticise. But I would say that first you've got to look at the players, because the players are the ones that take the field, and ask them what the honest answer is. To answer your full question, I don't think Eddie losing his job has seeped into the squad, because I don't think any of the players in there really care what the media says and care what the fans say. Genuinely, I hate to burst
the
bubble.
That's exactly what Jack said a couple of weeks ago.
And again,
he doesn't read it.
I've run a joke about the fans and everything else that since. Like, I love the fans, right? The whole reason I played rugby was to play on that big stage. Without the fans, rugby would be shit out. You'd just be running around in an empty stadium. We saw that with COVID. Awful. I love the fans. I think opinion, interaction, love, hate, you know, buying into the media, that is what makes sport good. So it's utterly brilliant. What I get upset with about, when I always sort of talk about, is the lack of rational thought and the quickness to criticise, especially to be negative and nasty. You know, it's the weirdest thing. You wouldn't do it in any other thing. Normally you go, you tried your best. In sport, it's cancel them, burn them, fire them, you're shit, retire, he's awful, because it breeds conflict. And the genuine thing is with the players, we just don't see it. We just don't care. And that's the point. And they all get so upset. And now because of social media, it seeps in more. But I don't think that camp, I think a lot of those players would be siding with Eddie and laughing and more upset with probably peers and other people coming out and slagging them than... Do you understand?
Like, yeah, you know, exactly, like, so what you're saying.
Because the boys walk in and go, did you see what that dickhead fuckhead said about us?
Yeah.
You know, or I'm going to go up and tell that journalist he's talking shit or whatever. That's more the conversation you'd have. I don't think being in there, and again, I'm hypothesising, but I don't think it's seeped in. I think they're too busy focusing on getting the job done. I think Eddie does not play the game at all, which is half the reason people haven't liked him. And I think that if you deflect, and if you have a character, and if you do things in a completely different way, and you swim upstream instead of downstream with the flow, when you things don't go well, everyone's out. And it is such a vitriol. It is such an art. Yeah, it's like incredible. And it's, I imagine it's, you've seen it with Jose Mourinho, you've seen it with, you know, I see it with Conor McGregor, you see it with Floyd Mayweather, you see it with anyone who doesn't play or doesn't toe the party line gets absolutely hammered. And Eddie, you know, has been to most teams in the world. He's had incredible success. You know, I'd back him 9 times out of 10. I just don't understand the rationale as to why you would want to fire him. Are England playing well enough? No. You know, do they probably need a change? You know, yes. I don't think getting one of the most successful World Cup coaches of all time out the mix is a good idea.
What do you mean by change then?
Well, I just think, you know, I think I would start with the players. I'd start having a look at yourself and go, right, you know, is it we're not playing a game plan that suits us? Is that the one thing? Are players playing well enough? Are they, you know, are the individuals doing well enough? Do we need to change some of the coaching?
The three sort of big decisions that seem to be floating around in the paper is, can Owen Farrell and Marcus Smith play together? And a lot of people saying, start Farrell at 10 with Tuilagi and Slade,
yeah,
and put Marcus Smith on the bench. Potentially even someone like George Ford comes back into the World Cup reckoning because of his nous understanding, second coaching ability type thing. The other thing that a lot of people are talking about is the balance of the back row. Alex Cole's obviously at 6 on Saturday against the Box, but is that a back row that is going to take the game and play the game at the speed that England are trying to, or is that a back row that's built defensively and to go well in the lineup?
Well, it was to go well in the lineups, but it didn't work, yeah, did it? So, you know, they didn't win. I mean, as I said, they won six out of nine lineups. Yeah. So, which is, we don't know what, you know, 66%. The minimum standard for an England lineup is 95% or 92 to 95%. That's it. Yeah. You know, like even then, you want more. The KPIs are higher across the board than all of that.
Right. So
I would say no. I'd say the balance of the back row is way more important. I think, you know, we've got some players missing. I think we need to go back probably to the drawing board and look at what we're about. And I think this will be an interesting wake-up call and a big analysis. And I think, you know, knowing that Eddie goes around looking at other teams, looking at other sports, reviews heavily what happens during this period of time, and you know, Reed tries to rebuild the game.
The Chris will say though that in isolation everyone has a bad day, but it's in when you couple it with the 71 minutes against the All Blacks in which they were very, very average.
Yeah,
the loss
to
Argentina.
I watched that All Blacks game back again. Right, All Blacks for 40 minutes were
sensational,
fucking unbelievable.
So I agree with you, but the All Blacks were unbelievable 40 minutes. Springboks were very, very good on Saturday in victory at Twickenham. The challenge, therefore, is when were England last really good? Now, they had 20-odd good minutes against the Wallabies in the summer, but they haven't put together one of those defining performances, really, since the final, as the semi-final in 2019. We haven't seen a statement performance from England, really, in 3 or 4 years. There's been the odd flash in the pan. There's been the odd, you know, victory. There's been a lot of disappointment. And that, I think, that build-up of, is it Eddie's fault? When you couple all of those together... Yeah. Is when people start to say, yes, it is. I think the other thing that fans are very irritated by is that Eddie has been talking about the World Cup for 4 years. Everyone says, but that ignores all the good stuff that goes in between. What I think is very interesting, though, is a lot of people are equating that to the Red Roses, who won 30 games on the trot but lost the one they really wanted. They will say, well, look at that body of work. I would slightly disagree with that.
I would agree. I
think the Red Roses would have put 15 defeats into those 30 victories to have won the one they wanted.
Yeah. That's people who say stuff like that, people are not involved in sport. What is the point of having all the foreplay and none of the fun? It's not bad. It's not bad, but that's the ultimate goal.
I think you're absolutely right. So I want to chat to Alex because we'll try and get the inside scoop. There's only so much he can say, of course. I'm going to throw a couple of things at you, which I don't think other people will be discussing. How about this? £1 on an England Six Nations trophy lift in 2023. 5-1. England start at Twickenham, taking on Scotland. England will be packed with anger. They've lost the last two to the Scots. They go well in game one. They've then got Italy, much improved, but you would back England to do that. Suddenly you're 2-2 and you're getting a bit of momentum in. Then they go to Cardiff to take on a Wales side. Who knows where they'll be at that point. I reckon Scotland will beat Wales in round two as well, so Wales will be coming off a defeat. Could be problems. Then they've got France at home, England. By this point, I think France will have lost in Dublin. Is this French side that we've seen in November good enough to go to Dublin and win and come to Twickenham and win? We shall see. And then it's all on. Ireland against England, 20 years on from Jono's refusal to walk up and down the red carpet. Grand Slam decider. England would do what they did in 2019. Absolute bollocks, but someone's got to say it. Things have happened.
I put a pound on it. I just don't see it. Some of the other results, I would never back. Whilst Eddie's in charge, I would never bet against him.
So we did this nonsense thing the other day about the fact that everybody is beating everybody. And I do think the rugby landscape is changing so quickly at the moment. I mean, if you look at the summer, the Springboks probably should have lost a home series to Wales.
Yeah.
They then put in a really mighty performance against England in the last game of the season. Everyone says, oh, Box are right where they want to be coming into the World Cup. They should have lost to Wales in the summer.
Yes.
Full stop.
And also, and again, because they're levelling it against them, losing a certain number of players, right?
Yeah.
I would have said, because this isn't talked about, that if you were in that South Africa side and you weren't going to start, and you got an opportunity to play against England, and the coaches said to you, you know, and you knew you wouldn't be in there, and this is your one moment to fucking turn up and play and get an opportunity to potentially keep that other player out and to hold a marker down, that's what you do.
Yeah.
Would you think they were going to come in and just play crap because Ches and Colby normally starts in front of them all?
Damien Willemser at 10.
Yeah, Willemser, Yasavisa.
Third choice fly half.
Right. All those players stood up and counted, and they did what they were supposed to do. They don't know they're second-rate players, or just because the media's labelled them as second-rate players and missing players, they're not. They're starters for their clubs. They're proud Africans. You know, they want to come to Twickenham and smash up England. They did well. I just don't see the desperation. And I saw things levelled against Adam Radwan, right? So Adam Radwan, everyone was upset. Adam Radwan came into the squad on a Sunday, went back on Tuesday because he lives in Newcastle, right? That happens to every player every week since every England coach has ever been on. It's his fault he lives in Newcastle. It's got nothing to do with it. You don't keep a... Just because he comes down to England... He, Adam Ramwood hasn't said anything, by the way. I think he's a great player. He's not complained. But I saw people label that against him.
Maltreatment.
Right, maltreatment. It's not maltreatment. It's what happens. You know, I don't understand...
He gets paid to do it as well.
Yeah, of course he gets paid to do it. And this is what people forget. If you come in to train, to pick up experience, to see how you perform... And again, I don't see, because I don't have the mentality to watch hours of footage, but I've told you, what we see in a Premiership game and what he can do as an individual, I wonder if you put a player cam on it. I'm not saying this is in his case, but I've talked about all the other nuances of a game. You know, is he the right fit at this point in time to fit into an England squad? Would there be some positional issues? Would there be some game plan stuff that he might not be okay with? Is it important he comes down and trains Sunday, Monday, Tuesday? So when he does get the call, he's across it. Would you want to start him against South Africa as your first game at Twickenham? Probably not. We've seen how that goes in the past. You know, there's a bit of management. I don't think sending players back on a Tuesday, that's always happened, is maltreatment. But that's what people are levelling at him.
Three realistic... If they do, and I'm sure there are big meetings happening, and probably happening quite soon around RFU Towers. Three genuine contenders if they do get rid of Eddie. Warren Gatland, who you know we love. Yeah. Amazing how short the memories go. That Lions series in 2021 did not consist of a lot of rugby from those in
rugby. And look, and I love Gats, but there are players...
Very good at getting a bounce.
He is very good at getting a bounce back. He's very good at getting the emotional energy. He's also got good coaching staff around him. So he had, you know...
Sean Edwards.
Yeah, he's had Sean Edwards, had Andy Farrell. Oh, no, he didn't have Andy Farrell in the line. Who did he have? He had Townsend.
Steve Tandy.
You know... Gats also thrives with good support staff, so you have to look at who else you'd bring in, who would the opportunity to bring in. And also remember, I haven't said this, but people have come out on tours and criticised the way he coached on those tours.
Sean O'Brien, 2017.
People came out and said things. You know, nobody is impervious to that. Well, I mean, who else on the list?
Well, I think the other two would be Scott Robertson at the Crusaders. No international experience and is used to working within an environment where... You know, it's within the NZRU.
And they're all unbelievable to play the Crusaders, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Not saying
and Ronan Ogara would be the other, who has obviously just won the European Cup with La Rochelle. But again, not coached.
Not coached the World Cup.
International level. Been to a few World Cups.
And again, what I always think people forget about coaching... I mean, I'd love to ask Gareth Southgate, I think, would say the same. I think anyone who coaches an English sport or rep or an English national team would probably tell you it's 90% about the media... Yeah. Clubs, you know, and 10% about actual coaching.
Yeah,
and you've got to be strong-willed to do it. And we've seen what happens if you're not strong-willed. You can't deal with the pressure. You fall apart. I the only person I think you could bring in at this stage would be Warren Gatland, if you have to. I just personally think the most successful World Cup coach would probably be the best person to have in the job. I would say this is a blip in form. I think the pressure's not helping. I think the constant criticism of the coach isn't helping. I think looking to pick holes in things is probably not helping. But I'd love to get asked, and we'll ask Ellis, has it seeped in?
So let's get to Ellis. I think what we're saying in summing up is that it was a bad November. These things can come round very quickly, as we've seen with New Zealand this year and with South Africa this year.
We can turn this round in 3 months.
Yeah.
2 months. 100%. By the time
the
Six Nations comes...
That's the point about the rugby landscape at the moment, is, and we're repeating ourselves over and over, everybody is beating everybody. Don't go too early on World Cup form. Obviously, we want to see better success and better game plans and better product on the field. But if we're looking at all of the factors which we're talking about there, which is chaos... uncertainty, pressure.
If we listen to all those people who say get rid of everyone, we'd never get anywhere. I just think with a bit of fact and cold heart, I just think players aren't playing well. I think it's a difficult period of time at the moment. I think autumn great wasn't great. There's no one better to lead them. And if all the players in the squad, if any of you listen to this, you probably don't know I'm talking shit, then tell me, but some of you come out and say, because I think if Eddie felt that the players weren't happy with him, he'd walk away himself.
Yep.
But I just don't think that's true.
So... We have taken the questions, we have been challenged to give an answer, and we have rationally given an answer to the question, should Eddie stay or should he go? When you look at a bigger picture, when you look at what's happening across the landscape right now, when you listen to a man who's been there, done it, and played under him, there's your answer. Let's say, I can't believe for the first time this season, let's say a very warm welcome to Mr. Ellis Genge. I'm going to start with a question that I'm not imagining you've heard very much recently. What about a pound on England to win the Six Nations at 5-1?
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Was that the odds?
Yeah, 5-1 at the moment. Start with Scotland. at home, then Italy at home, Wales away, France at home, Ireland away.
If I was a better man, I'd probably take that bet. Don't know if I'm allowed to give out that advice.
As long as you don't make any bets, yeah, you're absolutely fine. And please gamble responsibly.
Yeah. We will classify and clarify, making sure you're in the right place at the right time. Jesus, the flak is flying, isn't it? How are you, first of all? How are you getting on?
I'm good, mate. Came back yesterday. It's Monday today. Yeah, came back yesterday. Obviously, a long time away with the boys. 5 weeks in total. But like the partners and kids came up on the weekend, so really nice to see them. Took the edge off it a little bit when the heat was on. Obviously after the Argentina game to start, and then really good win against Japan. Mental comeback against NZ, and obviously ended on reasonably low with the final game against Africa. But I'm okay, mate. Body's in one piece. Mind's not paced. I'm all good.
Tell us about Saturday. Is it one of those days where you just didn't manage to get the safety catch off, or was it a day where you just have to say, do you know what, well done the better man, they were too good for us?
Yeah, they were definitely too good for us on the day, weren't they? Clearly. I think we struggled at set piece, which pains me to say, on the day. I think they're obviously very, very good in that area, great in the kick battle. And yeah, like you said, we probably left safety on for too long and didn't fire any shots. Probably didn't have the opportunity to fire any shots, really. And they were brilliant. Yeah, hats off to them. Can't take anything away from them, really. Sometimes when you come away from losses, you think if we would have done this, if we would have done that. But no, they won majority of the 50-50s, and yeah, I thought they were brilliant.
Hello, Ellis. How are you?
Hello, James.
How are you? You eat a lovely chocolate biscuit, aren't you, Sammy?
You're a grass what now was it? As well, eh?
Well, you're allowed to eat a biscuit. A man of your stature with your rig, you're on fire, aren't
That's
you?
That's the only good thing about having kids, mate. You get to eat their snacks. I was eating those animal biscuits.
Oh,
yeah, they're so good.
Fish fingers and beans, leftovers. Yeah, those. I mean, if I go straight for those. You're apple puree at the moment.
Yeah,
aren't you?
Well, no, Bodie's on. Yeah, I'm on the boob. I'm on the boob as much as Bodie is.
Yeah, you bloody are.
I was like, obviously, I don't do that. That'd be weird, but I always just give her a little elbow. Budge up. And she just looks at me and starts smiling. And she's on formulas. There's nothing fun.
We're trying to have an England rugby.
Sorry, anyway, England do. Okay, Ellis, before you come on, I'm going to preface this, right? Is obviously, I am labelled a single minded Eddie Jones fan. I know nothing about anything. I'm completely wrong. I just kiss his ass. Everyone thinks you should fire him. Now, I know you're still in the squad.
And vice captain.
And obviously got responsible. But can you honestly just shed a bit of light on this and go, has Eddie lost the plot? Has Eddie lost the squad? And should everyone fire Eddie? I know you still want to play for England. But ultimately, you can be honest in some regards. And I think I know what the answer is going to be anyway.
Yeah, look, I think, like I said, the week before this, we were 9 minutes the greatest team ever for scoring 20 points against NZ in 9 minutes. So I don't think one game defines any team. I don't think it's his fault that we lost in the manner that we did on Saturday. We debriefed it after. We actually we'll take onus for it. Eddie's brilliant. He takes a lot of heat off the players and says like it's his fault he didn't coach well enough. But personally, and I think probably from a boys' perspective as well, that it was probably on us, to be honest. We got a lot wrong. We prepped really well, felt good going into the game. And it's one of those days you find out a lot about each other. So every cloud, no one's happy about it. And you know, like everyone always gives people shit and says audacious statements. But like, as you know, mate, from first-hand experience, he's the one hurting the most. He'll be up for countless hours trying to figure out where he could have went better and the boys in general as well. So that's a long-winded answer to no, I don't think any of the above.
When you do the debrief meetings, right, because I think sometimes fans, you know, they hurt. Fans think they always hurt more than the players, which is so bizarre. They always think, you know, they care more than the players do, which is obviously always so far off the mark. And they think someone like Eddie would be coaching the team in a detrimental way. Obviously, I don't want you to talk out of school, but when you have an analysis meeting like that, how honest are you about the situation and what was the stuff that came out of it? Like, you know, did you said the players accept responsibility? You know, how hard on each other were you in that meeting?
Yeah, I mean, obviously everyone was quite emotional the day after, so sometimes you probably don't necessarily get all the detail that you want because emotions are high, so it's probably more so, is bollocking the word? Probably not. It was a highly emotive meeting, got a lot of honest feedback. We had a lot of honest conversations, and we always do it, mate. We've done it when you were here. Like, we have a debrief, don't we? Like, we say what we think's gone really well, because some things did go really well. And then as well, we share what we think could have been better, and how we're going to improve on it. So yeah, it was, I think everyone could probably imagine what the meeting was like day after. It definitely wasn't sunshine and roses as you'd expect, but there weren't chairs flying around the room or anything, but it was an honest, raw conversation.
There's a quote here that Alex actually read earlier from, I don't know if it's in here, that was Alistair Eakin quote.
The quote was, he is hearing off-the-record testimonies of unhappy experiences in camp. This is Al Eakin, the BT Sport commentator. Does that ring true to any back corridor conversations you're having?
What does that mean? Players in camp speaking to him?
What he's hearing is that players are very unhappy in camp.
Really? Yeah. Really? That's news to me. I think with the leadership group that we've got at the moment, we're quite immersed in terms of like socially amongst the boys, and we have a reasonably good feel. But if that's true, then clearly we don't. So I'd have to have a few conversations. Yeah, personally, I'd be very surprised if that's true. But there's no smoke without fire, I guess. So it's opened my eyes up. Definitely, I'll go searching.
But also, Ellis, in regards to that, every coach, I mean, let's be honest, when you first came in with Eddie, when you were, how old were you came in the squad?
21. Well, 20 and then 21. Turned 21 shortly.
21. The journey you've been on with him as a player and a coach is almost like night and day, isn't it? In terms of, you came in, fair to say, rough around the edges, you know, he was pretty hard on you a couple of times early doors. I mean, you know, what... Yeah, extremely hard, right? But then now he speaks more fondly. I mean, he almost speaks in the same light of how he speaks about me, but obviously I'm a better lad, so he'll never speak completely like that. But he does. You went on a journey. There's always going to be players that can't handle that. I mean, I don't know if you want to tell the story or maybe not, but, you know, there was a time where he had some pretty harsh words, and I think if it wasn't Dylan putting an arm around and saying, look, get back in the mix, and the character you are, you showed it, and you've come on this journey. But if I was to ask you in those early days what you thought of Eddie, you probably say he's a fucking idiot, you know.
No,
but
I've always been very honest with him, and I've probably used a bit stronger language than you used there, to be honest with him. But I think he appreciates that, especially coming from me. Like, if I think he's acted in a certain way or treating me a certain way, I've always told him. And I think personally, like, what people sometimes forget when they get subdued in or immersed in like the rugby environment is that sometimes they forget, like, you're a human as well. Like, you're a person. So like, for you, like, morally, the way you act inside camp should be the way you act outside of it as well. And if you wouldn't stand for that outside of it, you shouldn't put up with it in camp, you know. Like, if you're acting outside of your comfort zone, you know, like, if you're not giving feedback to people, then obviously it's going to be that way. And that'll go for players as well. Like, I've probably, potentially, they've said the same about me to Ali Eakin, but I don't see that firsthand. I speak to players, and obviously, mate, people get rockets, and that's elite sport. That's the elite environment. It happens in top-end businesses. The bosses go nuts.
What happens with good top end businesses? A lot of times it doesn't happen
in
the soft ass world we've got now.
Why their businesses fail, and it's probably because you're not having harsh conversations with your staff. So that's something that I think he's realised, definitely this generation, anyway, of younger players, that you potentially can't act or operate the same way you did 10, 15 years ago. I think that's a general rule in society now. You can't say half the stuff that you used to say anyway. So, like I said, no smoke without fire. So it's just eye-opening for me, and then I'll definitely have a little dig.
Being comfortable, being uncomfortable, that top-level sport is about, you know, inches and performance, and you're going to have harsh conversations because that's how you get better, and some people can't take it, some people can. And when Eddie first came in, he said, listen, I'm going to take you to a place you've never been before. You need to back me. Some of you in this room won't make it. Some of the coaching staff won't make it. The reason I don't think it is true, and by all means, you should always go digging, but how many people have we had now on the show that have talked about the way Ellis handles the players? I mean, it was someone the other day just talking about how well he has looked after, how well he's looked after the
Freddie Stewart.
Yeah. All these guys have said, since you become a leader, since that, well, you're always a leader in your own way, but since you became a proper leader in that last summer's USA and whoever else you played game, you know, you've taken a real interest in looking after young players and really have a finger on the pulse of know what's going on. That's why if there was some sort of disaster or people talking in corners, you'd probably be the first person to know about it. If you haven't heard about it, then it doesn't mean it hasn't happened. But fuck me, it's not a pandemic like it's being made out, is it?
No, it's not. There's no pandemic going on, as far as I'm aware. But like I said, potentially we might have missed something. It happens, doesn't it?
You missed all the guys with placards and like burning torches and get rid of Eddie.
It's a tough question, isn't it? But like that's what those conversations were for on Sunday, and I felt we got everything out there. There was some really good, honest conversations. So if people didn't speak up then geez, I don't know when they would.
When you look at this year, so I mean, I hope you haven't been, but there's a lot of crap flying around, as we said, a lot of opinion flying around. 42% win ratio this year. It could have been very different. It could have been very different for everybody. And what we're talking about regularly is just how tight it is between the top 10 at the moment. But why have England not delivered this year what you've all set out to? Can you put your finger on the little bits that aren't quite clicking? Or is it just the state of the game, the fluctuations in sport, the nature of these things at the moment?
Yeah, it's always been very prominent in rugby who the best team is. Thinking that sort of between 2011 and 2015, it was New Zealand by a long, long way. They had a 92% win rate, and I think they're on 70% or something now. So that shows how the standards moved of the game. There's a tight cluster at the moment. I didn't know that we had a 42% win rate this year. That's obviously not where we want to be.
But when you talk about, when you gather as a clan, what is it that you're talking about? What have you not got that you're looking for?
In terms of rugby?
Yeah, as a team.
Well, if I knew that, mate, we wouldn't have a 42% win rate. I know what you're trying to say. What do I think we haven't got? I know it sounds like a reasonably easy and soft excuse, but we have got a lot of young players that haven't played a lot of test rugby together, and that's not an excuse for not performing, but we are finding out a lot about each other in a rugby sense, so it becomes second nature. You think that Ireland teams had a long, long time together playing with each other. They play centrally contracted at every single club. I think Leinster makes up 80-odd% of their squad. So, I think it's tough, coming in together with such a short turnaround as English clubs where we all play such different brands of rugby. Literally complete opposites. And again, it sounds like an excuse, but it's a fact. But that's not something that we're going to let hold us back. We have to find the way to get over that. Because our last four competitions, I think we've lost the first game every single time. Autumn's, Six Nations, prior to that. So it's clearly an issue. When we get together, we don't get the ball rolling quick enough. So I think that's something that we identified and that we're going to have to action.
Do you still enjoy it? Are you enjoying it, playing for England? Is it still fun?
Losing's not fun, mate.
No.
Winning's fun. I want to win. I enjoy the boys, I enjoy camp, I enjoy the environment, brilliant environment. I love working hard, I love working towards a goal, but ultimately, no, I don't enjoy losing. But yeah, I love playing for my country, I love representing my people, and I love the boys and the environment.
Do you think, again, because armchair pundits and people pass opinion, and unfortunately, I have to, when I was walking around Twickenham, I have to sort of put up with it. People always want to ask me about it. Do you think, you know, when Eddie
man
came...
Man of the people to my left. Proper man of the people.
Proper man of the people, yeah. When Eddie came in, right, he looked at the England team and he said, we've gone away from our roots. I never forget that first training session when we were passing the ball out the back, rugby league, and Eddie went, for fuck's sake, why the fuck are you playing rugby league? And we pointed out we'd had three rugby league coaches coaching us for X amount of years, and that was the game plan. He said no, and he kept saying, just fucking run, Billy, run, stop passing it. And then obviously we went into a period of time where we became set piece orientated, we became defence orientated, and tack came off the back of it. Do you feel like the way England wants to play, and I'm talking about the way you guys train, because I know at the moment sometimes it isn't translating to the field, do you feel like you're playing a brand of rugby or training a brand of rugby that suits you guys, that you feel that if you were to get it right, you would be in a great place?
Well, we're trying to, there's something that we're trying to do, we're trying to have every answer for whatever's thrown at us and being able to adapt in that sense, so essentially be equipped to play any which way that we need to win the game. I know that sounds reasonably bland, but if you would have spent the hours that we spent in the meetings, you'd understand the bigger picture. And obviously, it's not not my space to go and tell the world our game plan, but
no. I'm not asking for that. I'm just more like, do you feel like, you know, you said about different clubs playing different ways, right? Sometimes when I've gone to an England camp and they say it was a very Leicester dominated coaching staff and a very Leicester heavy side back in the day, you would end up playing a certain way because that was the predominant thought process around it. Eddie, I know, he came in with one identity. He subsequently changed it. And he's giving you different tools for different occasions. So if you're playing the All Blacks, you play a certain way. If you're playing South Africa, you play, and hopefully try to be able to make decisions on the field to change quickly. If Owen calls you in or Marcus calls you in and says, right, listen, lads, you know, we need to go to this kind of game plan. You guys are all away with it. I just wanted to know, do you feel like when you're out there training, is the stuff you're putting together on the training field, even though it might not be coming out in the field in the actual test match, are you comfortable with it? Do you enjoy it? Do you think it's the right thing to do? Do you feel like if it goes well, you're like, fuck me, we could beat anyone?
Yeah, well, firstly, I don't think you're ever comfortable in training. I think I know what you're trying to say, but just to, yeah. I know what you're trying to say. Are we happy with what we're doing? Yeah, mate, I we're strong enough now. Probably not back in the day, but we're strong enough now, definitely. Like, we're trying to have a player-led environment. So that's why I say it falls on us, essentially, because we've got the tools and we're equipped to say whether or not it's going well for us, and we're the ones who train, we're the ones who put the work in, and we need to stand up if that's the case and tell Eddie that we need to do something else. But we're all invested, and like, as far as I'm aware, we're all on the same page. So I think sometimes when you have performances like we did on Saturday, which, by the way, I think was only a 14-point difference, although they had a red card, we probably should have done a lot better. When you have these low periods, like I remember in 2018, we lost something like 7 games on the bounce and went and got into a World Cup final. And ultimately, we fell short. I'm aware of that. But it's not necessarily the end of the world. Like, we go through like a working out period and we're trying to find out a lot about ourselves. And for me, as long as we get the answers to the questions that are being asked, then it's good.
How far away do you feel from what you're trying to do? Does it feel like you're 1 or 2%, or does it feel like you're looking for 10-15?
No, at the very, very most, it's a few percent. We're only ever a few percent off. Argentina beat the All Blacks 1 week and lost by 40 points the next. I spoke to people in the Argentina camp, they said we were 1 or 2% off, and that's the difference in Test rugby. You get punished for 1 or 2% badly, so that's the difference.
I mean, that's what I get. Look, it's weird because I'm saying what you were saying, that I don't think it's a disaster. I don't think we're in a bad place. I think Eddie Jones is the man to the job. I think the guys that matter are happy. I mean, Alex said, asked me a question, right? He said, look, when you're in camp and you feel like your coach is under pressure, whether that's at the club or the media are having a go, I said it doesn't, especially someone like Eddie, it doesn't seep in because everything is purposeful, everything is how it's meant to be, everything's tough, you know, you're having good conversations, you're enjoying what you're doing, and Eddie is deflecting all this stuff. It doesn't affect the boys, does it? I wouldn't say the England squad feels like it's under pressure, does it?
No, we are under pressure, of course we are, to perform. Like, that's the reality of, like I said, top end sport or top end business, anything that you're involved in at elite level, there's always pressure. It's how you let that pressure affect you. It brings out the best in some people. I know what you're talking about. You're talking about external pressures. You're not talking about performance yes. pressures. You're talking about the media, the fans, those sort of pressures and the murmurs and the noises. I don't think we've ever let noise affect us. Definitely not in the later years. It's never ever been a problem for us. And I think Eddie's, like you said, brilliant at managing that and in controlling that emotional state that probably could rile a few teams up.
I'm going to read you a passage from Owen Slott, who has said in his Times article, when you watch England, you see an extremely gifted generation playing beneath themselves, shorn of confidence and lacking direction. Do you recognise that?
Do I see that? Well, I don't watch to start with. I've been playing recently, so probably very, very
'cause you're big time.
Yeah, very different from the armchair, I guess. I know I kind of guess what people are referring to, but this is what people don't understand, is that like the last 9 minutes against New Zealand, we played a certain way at the beginning of the game, right? And then at the very end of the game, albeit the yellow card, that opened up because of the way we played for 60-65 minutes. So when you say, people say, why are they kicking the ball? Or why are they doing this? And there's always a game plan and we're always trying to execute it. And sometimes you can't execute it for whatever reason. Like, these are good top quality teams, and if they counteract what you're trying to do to them, then they're going to win the game. But for people to say that we're playing beneath ourselves, I think that's very extreme. For me, that means that we look scared or not expressing ourselves. I disagree. I think that we are, but it's test rugby. Like, we don't. Did you see the South Africans chucking the ball between their legs, doing bicycle kicks and backflips? No, they were playing pressure plus rugby, and they were doing it very well. So, are they playing beneath themselves? I don't think so. I think they express themselves in the way that they're best expressing themselves: tough, scrum, line out, kick, chase, and that's them playing beneath themselves. No, it's not. That's them playing to their full potential, and that's what they do. But just because they're winning, people say that they're not playing beneath themselves. If we were winning, people wouldn't be saying that. But I guess that's, well, that's devil's advocate, isn't it? Because obviously we're not winning, that's why people are saying it. I'm still thinking still on that, Alex.
I love hearing you're having an existential crisis while listening. You're like, there's a hole in the universe opened up above your head as you're like
glitching the matrix.
But you know, you boys, I mean, I think, when I say not with confidence, I think, you know, if you're against a good opposition and the margin and time and space are down, you know, what do people expect to see with confidence? I think I saw people playing with confidence. I saw you playing with confidence. I don't agree with people aren't playing with confidence. What does confidence look like? That's what I mean. What, everyone just fucking smiling, running around?
It's a results-based business.
That's what I mean.
Yeah,
that's
not
winning masks everything. If you kick a late penalty against Argentina, we're having a very different conversation right here, right now. The reason this is really interesting for me, Ellis, is that there are, and probably more so than any point this year, there are a lot of people having a lot to say, and everyone is imparting their wisdom and projecting their views and offering their opinions on what this England team is about and the problems that are going on. And what it seems to me, and you correct me if I'm wrong, actually when I came to Pennyhill to chat to Jack the other day, and I wasn't allowed through security to have a catch up with you, but Jack was remarkably calm about it, and again, it hadn't gone very well against Argentina, but he's like, you know, this is a journey. You're saying exactly the same kind of thing. Eddie is talking a lot about this World Cup plan. Do you feel at this point that, not necessarily on track, but that you are learning enough and fast enough and gathering the things you need to gather, that by the time we get to Rugby World Cup next year, you will have progressed significantly from this point?
Like I said earlier, we did the same in 2018, didn't we? Right this second, like, look, it wasn't the plan to lose against South Africa. It was the plan to win every single test. We don't ever plan on losing a test or underperforming, but in terms of learning, yeah, we definitely are. And probably Eddie as well, finding out about people, players, combinations, stuff like that. But my job and the players' jobs is to play well, lead, feedback, be honest, be open. Game's changing rapidly, and we want to be ahead of the curve, and like, we got it wrong, like, badly on Saturday, I guess. So, but again, like, the set piece didn't function, and like, ultimately that falls on the forwards and in front row. Like, Eddie can't come down and scrum. I don't think he can anyway. He can't come down and it's scrum. I'm sure he would, but he can't come down and scrum for us, can he? So, like, we need to sort that out. It's not on him.
Eddie is talking a lot about holding stuff back for the World Cup. And actually, when I saw him at Pennyhill Park, he said, you don't want to be showing your hand now. And there was a very good something put out in social media, and I can't remember what the context was, but it was something around the fact that you can now combat a game plan inside a week on a training pitch. Teams now are so well versed that you can see what your opposition does in the game before, identify what they're trying to do, and you can build a sort of a mechanism to combat it inside a week, which you tell me whether I'm right or wrong or not. But Eddie is talking a lot about holding stuff back for Rugby World Cup 2023. Can you give us a little percentage on how much time you are trying things in training that you haven't yet put out on a test match day?
Yeah, there's always times. No, there's always times that happens. Obviously, you practice things and they don't make it that week, and you save them for another opportunity. And there were moves that we were gonna use, and the game didn't present itself that way, so it didn't get used. But yeah, he's a very, very clever man. Been through a lot of World Cups, coached him, involved in a World Cup winning team in 2007 within South Africa. So he knows a lot more than me about that sort of stuff. So
He's been to three finals.
Three finals and one Japan
upset South Africa. People think you should get rid of him. I just don't. just don't understand what they're smoking. Obviously not good shit, because they're talking bollocks.
This is obviously in the hands of others, but what would your reaction be if they got rid of Eddie?
Jeez, that's a big question. I'm not going to use the word heartbroken. I think that's a very strong word. I'd probably only use that if my dog died.
You should have said, if your missus left you, you fucked that up, Ellis, for Christ's sake.
No, he considered it. He considered it. He was dog. Like,
Mrs. Dog.
I love her too.
It didn't even sound convincing. She's okay.
I would feel I'd be very confused. I'd be asking why they didn't speak to players first, which actually, if it did happen, they probably would. I'd ring him. That's what I'd do. I'd ring him. I'd speak to him. I don't really want to manifest it, to be honest, but I think we're probably getting a bit ahead of ourselves if we're thinking about that right now. Like I said, it's an Autumn Nation series. We won a game, drew a game, and lost two. Did a few other nations that probably expect to do a bit better than absolutely terribly as well, and I'm not seeing huge headlines about tearing the head off of them at the moment, but I guess that's what comes with being England rugby.
I think it's a very interesting answer.
We said, didn't we? Like, it's, you know, if you coach an English national team, you've got to expect to get grilled. Because, Ellis, do you find that unless you're being very negative about a team or people when you're kind of analysing them, you're not really doing a job? Because we try to be kind of relatively positive about kind of what we're doing, but you know, as a current player, you know, do you ever talk about it in the meetings when, you know, because everyone around sort of the England team in particular, but sometimes the club, if they're not saying harsh things and calling people out, apparently you're not, you're not giving a review. Do you think that's the case, or do you guys not genuinely think?
I understand as well, especially in media, that people have to scrutinise. It's this job. Like, if you don't call it out, then you get called all sorts yourself. So I absolutely understand it when people scrutinise. Something that I'm not on board with is when ex-players who've probably been in all those years ago, I actually wouldn't call it elite, but they were involved in what was elite sport at the time, and it changes monumentally, and I feel like they don't have a passive smirking, mate. You were involved in elite sport, don't worry.
It changes
monumentally along the way, and for them to speak as if those sorts of problems weren't posed to them, and they've never been in that sort of rut and had those questions asked to them, that's what sort of fires me up sometimes. But no, I totally understand negative press. I totally understand the fans being upset, like, we underperformed. Jeez, if I support Bristol Rovers, if they don't get a dub, I'm quite upset as well. So I get it. But sat at home is a very different game to when you sat in the dressing room.
What were your highlights of the autumn, if there were any, in terms of camp, any kind of bits and pieces? But, you know, was there some fun moments in there? Because I know that you're a big advocate of getting the boys together and, in, you know, making sure they enjoy themselves and stuff. Was there any kind of highlight bits you wanted?
Yeah, loads. I spent a lot of time with Dickie. I roomed with Dickie.
How was that?
Yeah, it was class, mate. My boy's probably old enough now to understand what other kids are doing and playing with them and stuff. So his boy's near enough same age. So when they came up on the weekend, we were getting in the pool with them and spending a lot of time with them. Well, spending a day with them after the game. So that was probably a highlight for me, having my son on the pitch after games. And look, I'd be lying if I said that the performances were highlights for me, because obviously, like I said, we let ourselves down in a lot of areas, but we built on a lot of things. We've done a lot of good in that time. Leadership grew, players grew, we found out about things we didn't know before. So the experience on a whole for me has been positive. I don't expect anyone to believe me to say that I'm happy that we've not won. I want to win. That's what I want to do. It's elite sport. That's what we want to do. But in terms of off the pitch, yeah, I've thoroughly enjoyed myself. I loved having my family there. My granddad came to his first ever game of rugby.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did he find that?
He loved it. It was against Japan, so...
And you got to meet Pi as well.
But no, it was brilliant, and he told me he was really proud of me. It was emotional. He's never been to a rugby game ever, so... No, I loved that. That was probably the biggest highlight for me.
Bugger, I wish we'd mic'd him up. I'd love to have done that.
I don't know if you'd be able to wear some of the stuff.
Maybe not.
I was interested when you said about, because you've always talked about, you know, about your dad in a fond way, but always said, you know, you two have always had a kind of a quite an honest relation. He's quite tough on you. I wondered if he was just saying he's your dad's dad, and he said he's really proud of you, if that was like breaking a family tradition of like,
like to just have him there and see raw emotion and almost have a glint. I've never seen the bloke cry, but almost have a glint in his eye. That really touched me. So, and like being a dad now myself, you can, although he's not my old man, you can see how proud he was. And yeah, for me, that was more important than anything else.
See, that just puts everything in perspective, doesn't it? It's very, you know, we were talking again about, you know, my view of, obviously I want you boys to do really well. I want the England team to do well. Like, I don't live my life through whether you're successful or not successful. Like, you know, I still don't really mind if you win or lose. I just want you guys to be okay and have a good time. But when you have things like with your family and your grandfather there and kind of the relationships you're building, it kind of puts everything into perspective, really, because everybody hates losing. Everyone hates losing at Twickenham. No one wants it. But you kind of, you're able to pull yourself out of it by understanding there are bigger things at play, no?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's an eye-opener for everyone, definitely during the campaign. When things aren't going well, that's what puts a smile back in your face, you know? I always said, since I've had my boy, he's never upset whether I win or lose. So, yeah, it's definitely settling.
Can I ask you a couple of questions away from, obviously, autumn? So, well, it's not that much away, but vice skipper, how much does that mean? How much have you enjoyed that role?
Yeah, I've enjoyed it, definitely. It hasn't changed too much for me. Like Hask has alluded to, I probably was a very different character at the beginning of my England career to what I am now. So I think that's happened naturally. I'm very happy with how that manifested. I haven't tried to sort of force anything. It was reasonably quiet at some stages during the week because we've got such other experience in great leaders. And obviously, me and Mako were sharing the load at the time. So he's got 70 tests, I think. And what an incredible player he is. So it was easy, you know. It wasn't a hard task. We've done a lot of workshops, myself and Faz and Nolsey. And we built that relationship, we got better there. I enjoyed it, mate. Yeah, it's eye-opening. It gives you different experiences, doesn't it? And when you're a young whippersnapper running around and wondering what the leadership meetings are all about, you now you've got the answers. So I understand that a bit more too.
And they're not that far. I mean, I don't know what the answers are. What happens in the leadership meeting?
You always want to be in them, and then you actually get to them, and you think they're having cake and coffee. It's not quite
that.
No,
they're not. Yeah. No. I mean, I never made it into leadership meetings. I don't know. I was a naughty boy. No.
Outside.
They had to set up a special, you know, like, you know, everyone else got a role, and they couldn't find one for me, so they gave me like a special class. I always end up with a kit man in the van. He let me drive the van. He let me sit in the van and make noises with the steering wheel, like pretending to change gears, but he wouldn't put the keys in it.
Was that with us? I'm not sure if you can see this, but I'll tell you another time about the effort I went to get your World Rugby Dream Team of the Year shirt selected at Loosehead. Many congratulations. We actually put it on our mannequin behind me last week. But yeah, in the Dream Team for 2022. Another brick in the wall, another step on the journey. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, it was one of my goals for this year. It was to win the Premiership, get to the European final, and to be nominated for the shortlist. But obviously, I didn't make the shortlist, but I got in the wider squad. I think I've worked quite hard at my game, and I've never ever done it before, actually, to set individual goals. It was Steve who urged me to do it when I was at Leicester at the beginning of the year. Prior to the campaign, the Premiership, he said, let's set out some goals. And I said, what, individual ones or team ones? He said both. So I went away and set my goals. And yeah, I achieved all of them by the European one. So for me, I was extremely happy. But obviously, although again, it sounds like something everyone says, but you realise how important everyone else is. For me, I probably wouldn't have been nominated if it wasn't for having such a great team at Leicester and all those boys who helped me along the way, Steve and all the coaches around me that done so well for me. So, yeah, I was buzzing, mate. I was buzzing, but just not had much time to think about it at the moment.
We will keep your shirt and pass it on next time you're in. Two more quick ones to finish. How good being back in Briz?
Yeah, amazing, mate. I haven't spent much time here recently, obviously being away for the period with autumn, but the time that I have been, I've been able to see my nieces, my nephews. They've been round, family been come round having food. Easier for my partner because she's closer to Wales with her family. I think everyone's happier off the pitch. Obviously, like, I'm not going to beat around the bush. The rugby is not as good at the moment with where we are in the league table, Bristol. We've got Leicester this week, actually. So
the Ellis Genge derby.
Yeah, weirdly enough, me and Coley on the posters around Sam, the poster boys. But look, I'm absolutely loving life off the pitch. I ultimately think it was the best decision for me. My headspace is much, much clearer. Really enjoying life and definitely touching on what we spoke about earlier. When you put things into perspective, it's definitely done that for me.
Good on you. Last question. As we mentioned at the start, there are a lot of people with a lot to say at the moment around this England setup, around Eddie Jones, around your performances. What has been really good for us is to hear from you inside the camp, someone who's leading the way. What is your message to media, fans, etc., off the back of the November you've had and where you think you're going as a team? This is your moment almost to say, calm down, everyone, don't panic, we're going to be all right.
What's my message? My message is, it's a tight cluster at the moment. That's what it is. Ultimately, Test Rugby, the top 10 teams have never been closer together, I think. It's easy for me to sit here and say, have faith, you might not, and that's fine. I wholeheartedly believe in what we're doing, and that's all I can really give you. Thank you very much for the support of the Ormes.
Good on you. I think you've put that very well. I think we've tried to put together a show, which is, we've been challenged just for your, lots of people have come and said, you've got to say as you see it. We've actually spent a bit of time thinking about it and we've said what we've seen and we've heard from someone who's in there on the front line and that's where we net out.
It all seems to join up as well. Like, it's not left foot. And look, I understand. I just don't
think
Ellis,
I
don't think he's the kind of character that's not going to tell it how it is. You know, he'll always be very honest about everything. I think they're not far off. You know, Ellis said you've had a mega year so far. And I think, you know, a couple of backward steps to come forward as a team. And I don't see a problem with that. I don't think there's any need to panic. You know, you heard it here first, the boys are happy. And look, I genuinely, you'll go in to look into that, won't you? What Alistair Eakin said, and you'll find out.
And see
what the story is. And that's how the lads operate. They have difficult conversations. I think everyone just sits around going, well, never mind, and just walk away. Not all the players hurt more than anybody, hurt more than the fans, more than the journalists, more than anyone. They want to make it work, and it didn't, and that was it.
Can we do something much more fun soon?
Yeah.
We keep trying to find some fun in the game. Yeah. It's quite tough going. Are you pedal to the metal, presumably, for now? Or have you got a break at any point?
No, I've actually got a bit of time off after this week. We've got Europe. I'm not playing any of the Europe games, but my missus is literally about to pop, so...
You having another one?
Yeah, 18th of December. I thought I told you this.
No.
I think you did. Do you know what you're having or not?
It's a little girl. I might have said it. Yeah, it is a little girl. Yeah, Alex remembers. Thanks, Ask.
I
must have said it in tandem, mate, just a passing comment. I'm not too vocal about it all, to be honest.
Well, you want to get another hobby, mate? Fucking hell, you have two under two, aren't you?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Ever since you've given up the video game.
Raph's two and a half now. I haven't given it up.
Okay. Have you not?
Absolutely not. That's my skill.
You would have had 10. If you'd given up video game, you would have had 10, yeah.
Exactly.
And she needed a new hit.
That's the only thing stopping me. Yeah, let's do something. Definitely. I'd love to. Nolsey's got some good ideas. He spoke to me I think he spoke to you, Alex, about the Red Bull thing, going around and challenging people to other sports. That sounds pretty sick, doesn't it?
Yeah, we'd love to do that.
We'd love to do that.
Maybe lock in at Knowlesy's pub as well.
Yeah, we should have a few beers. I think that'd be quite good.
Oh, definitely a few pints, yeah. That spot that we went to in something green, wherever that was, I like that place.
Pass
the
screen.
Like that, the summer vibes.
Sony Pony, he liked that.
The kebab and
By the way, it was a healthy kebab. It was from Kebab Kid. It wasn't like, on the wall of kebab, it says Jamie Oliver, if you're looking for a healthy. Dennis and I weren't having doner kebabs and pints.
Well,
it was like a really
4 o'clock in the afternoon.
It was a calorie controlled thing. Okay, well, let's get smashed up and we'll do something good. Because, you know, that's what I said at the start of the show. I got free piss at Twickenham on Saturday and I just lost my mind.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you go full hask?
Yeah, full hask. But to the point where I was interviewing Joe Cock and a singer and Jonathan Joseph, having to literally pause. And, you know, at the moment, Alex asked you that question and you all that could see the equal signs and plus signs going around your head. I'd have to be nice, control your breathing.
I haven't told you about the debrief I had with the Twickenham lady off the back of your Q&A session.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, we'll talk about that on camera.
Oh, dear. Danger.
Ellis, lovely to see you.
Love you,
Thank
mate.
You for coming to... Yeah, I mean, this isn't the fun bit, but I think it's really good for us that you've said exactly what you think, because I think it needs to be heard. Let others say what they need to say, but you're the one doing it. So good on you. See you for a pint soon, hopefully. And good luck in the Ellis Genge Derby this weekend. Go get them.
Merci, merci. And see you all soon. Look forward to it.
Good on you, Ellis. Go forward, go forth and conquer. And we'll look forward to catching up with something a little bit more fun before too long. But always good to get the views from those inside, those doing the doing. It was nice to contrast that a little bit with those just doing the saying, if you know what I mean. Right, before we move on, we're going to say a very quick thanks to our favourite pizza makers, Domino's. And it's time for our Domino's Dough Baller of the Week, where we pick out our standout performers from the weekend's rugby. Two games, obviously. A number of incredible performances, mainly from Southern Hemisphere sides. Aaronsa, Etzebeth, Faf de Klerk, Willemse, Alan Wynne-Jones, of course, for the Northern Hemisphere, rolling back the years. King Ken Owens going well as well. And Noah Kantawasi and Donaldson for the Wallabies. I personally, though, have been given the great duty and the great honour of handing out the pizza this week, and I'm going to give it to Kurt Lee Aaronsa, mainly because of the incredible try that he scored, but secondly, because he looks an absolute whippet, and I think a good pizza on him may well help him for the next 12 months or so. So well done to the box in general. Hard to say as an Englishman, but Aaronsa is our dough ball of the week, and we'll send him some Domino's dough ball vouchers to get stuck into. And a quick note as well, do check out Domino's new Ultimate Spicy Sausage Pizza and Andujia Dough Balls. I hope I've pronounced that correctly. From our dough baller to a complete nutter gear change, though. And we mentioned at the top of the show the desperately, desperately sad news surrounding the great Doddy Weir. Capped 61 times by Scotland, scorer of a couple of World Cup quarterfinal tries against New Zealand in 95, a 97 Lions tourist, of course. His tour cruelly cut short because of injury that time. An extraordinary MND fundraiser as well. He has desperately, sadly passed away after an incredibly brave battle at the age of just 52. And to help us pay tribute to a truly brilliant man, his old teammate and friend, the one and only Kenny Logan. It's very, very good of you to join us, Kenny. In incredibly sad circumstances. And I just sort of want to start with that, really. Are you bereft and heartbroken and desolate, or have you been quite touched by the extraordinary outpouring of love that your old mucker has had across the rugby landscape this weekend?
Thanks for having me on. It's been a very emotional day, and yesterday was very emotional, and especially I think last night, just going through all the tributes and funny stories that he just laughed, and I laughed, spent most of the night laughing and crying about things about what Doddy had done and said. He's just left us with a big hole in our heart, really, because he was a phenomenal individual. Never mind what he'd done after his rugby career with the M&D, but before that, he loved to make people laugh, and he enjoyed having a good night and a good laugh. And then when M&D hit him, he took it on like he'd taken on anything else in his life. He just full steam ahead and wanted to find a cure. I remember the first time he'd sat down with the professors, and he says, right, if you don't want to be in this room, get out now, because I'm going to find a cure for this disease. And nobody left the room, and they're still in the room, still trying to find that cure.
How far back do you go with him? When did you first come across the big man?
The first time he punched me was probably, I was about 16, playing for Stirling County under-18s, and he was in their under-18s. And I sidestepped him once, then the second time, he just punched me in the head. So that was our first reunion, our first sort of meet.
How much did that define your relationship over the years to come, that kind of those antics? Because I saw something actually that Will Carling put on social media, just saying this is how I remember Doddy. And it was basically the two of you bickering up on stage.
Yeah. I mean, we got on really well because he was a farmer, I was a farmer. I got my cap when I was just turned 20. I was in the team at 19, and he was the only one I knew a lot of them, but I knew him because he was a farmer and played against him for years, and he was only 2 years older than me, so there was definitely a sort of a real good affinity with each other. But he was a winner, you know. Newcastle, he liked. He was quite aggressive. I don't know if Haskell, if you played against him, he wasn't scared of throwing a punch. He wasn't scared of letting you know. I look back and the things he used to do to Jim Telfer was insane. It was so funny the night before a game. And I remember once he went into his bathroom and put black boot polish all around the seat. And then we're playing against, we had a test match that day. And Jim Telfer comes in and says, "What are you looking at, Logan?" I said, "Nothing, Jim." And this big black ring around his arse. And he was getting the shower. And we were all laughing our head off. And that's what Doddy had done. You know, Doddy had sneaked into his room. But he did it. He loved it. Him and Gary Armstrong. You know, if they were walking around the hotel room the night before a game, you panicked a little bit because they could have been in your room. But nine times out of ten, it was the coaches they were after.
Good on him. It would take go after the coaches, would he? After that even more, because you know, there's one thing taking out the lads.
Big
you remember
time.
A memorable story?
Him and Gary Armstrong. Him and Gary Armstrong, renowned for it. They would, especially that he once did one with John Rutherford, who was the backs coach. They used to have a couple of beers on a Friday night, so he put him and Gary put Klimfoil over the toilet, and then when John Rutherford came in, he thought something wrong with the toilet because the pee was bouncing off it. So he phoned up the reception, something wrong with his toilet.
I love these anecdotes. I mean, you could go on for days and days and days. What I sort of wanted to get from you was, and you've touched on it there, actually, because there are so many tributes, and rightly so as well, but he was a man who definitely did not suffer fools gladly. He was warm, he was very funny, he was incredibly sort of charismatic, but he was quite sharp as well. Is that a fair kind of point to make at this point? You had to be on your wits around him.
Yeah, definitely, because if not, he would catch you out. And so you always had to be very wary what you said. If it wasn't right, he would just go, "That's bullshit." You know, so I loved about him. He was, what you see is what you get from Doddy. His journey's been, the last 6 years has been ups and downs, you know. He's had some great times and he's had some real lows. And how he's reacted to it all and how he, you know, he I remember him phoning me up. It was February the 24th, he phoned me up and said, it was February, it was before the Lions tour, it was a couple of months before he announced it. And he was trying to get some cheap flights to South Africa, to Australia. And he just slipped in, "I've got M&D, so I want to get there quicker." And I went, "What?" He went, "Oh, forget about that. Can you get me a deal with the flights?" And he hung up. Then I phoned him back and went, "Doddy, did you see you've got M&D?" He went, "Yeah, but I'm going to beat it." And that was the first time he told me. And I, because you knew what M&D was through your use of Andovese's, and also with Gerard Cunningham got it at Wasps. I don't know if you were there at Haskell at the time, but Gerard Cunningham got it. So we knew what, I knew what M&D was and knew what it did to the body. But he was just so positive about the fact that he'd beat it, and the doctor said he would only live 2 years and he'd be in a wheelchair in a year's time. So he just, his mental strength and his belief, and I saw him 2 weeks ago and he still had that little glint in his eye when you told a joke, and he tried to, his body was trying to laugh, and it was a pretty sad moment, to be fair.
I mean, just how big a legacy has he left? You know, he's raised over £8 million through the My Doddy Foundation, you know, and obviously he's done incredible work. Just how big a kind of a legacy would he leave in this time, you know, with all the kind of amazing work he's done and also raising so much awareness?
Yeah, that's a good point, Hass. I think if you spoke to him about 3 or 4 years ago, he'd have probably thought when he's not here, the foundation would just stop. But he's created such a big animal. It's, you know, we've pledged 8 to 9 million on research. We've probably raised a lot more than that because we can't just pledge every penny we get, because we've got to make sure we've got resources for the next year and the following year. He's raised a lot of money, but what he's done to M&D, he's put it on the map. He's put other, you know, do you know what? I spoke to somebody the other day who got M&D's. You know, he said to me, "Nobody knows me, but Doddy's given me something to fight for. He's made me go, right, if he can do it, I'm going to do it. I'm going to fight, I'm going to work hard, I'm going to do all the things that Doddy's done." And that full mental, his mental strength was his best bit about Doddy. He just believed that he was going to live longer. He believed. And do you know what? Doddy probably knew this. The last 3 weeks, he'd been everywhere. He'd been to the anniversary dinner. He'd gone to Murrayfield. He'd gone up at 5 o'clock in the morning to see Simfield. You know, he's done it for a reason, because I think he generally felt this was, there wasn't long to go, and he wanted to do as much as he could to make as big an impact as he could. And he has. The foundation will get stronger and stronger with Doddy's passing. It won't disappear. It'll just get bigger and bigger, and we'll find, hopefully, a cure for this horrible disease. And it's underfunded. That's this big thing. We need to raise more money. There's a lot of people getting it now. You know, Ed Slater, you know, Rob Burrows is another one. And so we've got to keep the fight and keep his legacy flying high.
If people want to donate and people want to help out, how do they go about doing that?
So they just go to the foundation. My name's Doddy Foundation, and there'll be a donation page on there. And there's loads of fundraisers we're doing. We've got a big announcement around the Rugby World Cup to come out in the next, probably just after Doddy Aid, which starts in January. So, yeah, there's a lot of things going on, and there's a lot of people willing to be part of this story and be part of that cure. I suppose my big thing was, I wish we'd... He's done so much for the disease and bringing people together, but I wish we'd seen a bigger chink in the armour where we could say, look, he has made a massive impact. I don't want to take that away, but I think he always wanted more. He wanted to say, well, I've created this tablet, this has done this, it's slowed it down by 60%. But Doddy was always like that. He was not going to take small steps, he wanted big steps. And he always pushed the researchers. And if you speak to the scientists, they just loved the fact that he was pushing them all the time. Have you tried this? Have you tried that? And that'll still continue.
We actually did a tour in May this year, and we did a show in Edinburgh. And I don't know if you remember this, but as we were going on stage, somebody wandered back and said, oh, by the way, Doddy Weir's here. And the three of us, with Michael alongside, went, oh, wow, Jesus Christ. And suddenly we felt, oh, God, we're going to have to properly be on our game, because one of the great entertainers in the room, I think he came with his boys, Hamish Angus and Ben. And as we walked on stage, we said good evening, everybody. We hadn't had many cheers or very much laughter throughout the course of the tour. But we started by saying, look, we have got amongst us one of the greats. Would you please say good evening to Doddy Weir? And the whole theatre stood as one and applauded him. And it was about the most moving thing that happened to us over the course of 16 shows. Unbelievably amazing to have him there. And we had a very brief catch up with him afterwards. But I wanted to ask you, do you think he was proud of the work that he'd done? Because it was always about the next thing, as you've said. It was always about wanting more. But was he proud of what he'd done? And was he touched by the incredible esteem and love and affection in which he was so obviously held?
He just wanted more and more and more. And I think a lot of good sportsmen have got that. They just want more and more and more. They want more success. He wanted to really push the boundaries. He has definitely done that. He has put M&D on the map in the UK and Europe. And even in America, people are talking about what he's been doing. In Australia, they're contacting the foundation about the work the foundation's done. You know, we are a research charity. You know, we're not... we do look pastoral care, but it's very much... Doddy said, look, this is where I want to go. I want to be all about research. I want to try and find something that makes an impact on people's life. Wherever, you know, we might just start slowing it down, but he believes we can find something that just can turn it backwards, to reverse it all. And that's his big thing. And if you speak to the researchers, they do believe they'll find something, but we need to be funded.
I only sadly got to meet Doddy at it... the dinner we did in, where was it, in Switzerland?
Geneva.
Yeah. Did the dinner in Geneva. I'd never met Doddy beforehand, so I met him there and obviously then saw him on tour. I'd never had an opportunity. Obviously, I'd heard a lot about him. I think, Kenny, for those people who didn't meet him, I know you've shed a little bit of light on his character, but could you give him, if you were going to sum him up to some people in a few words, what would you describe Doddy as? Because obviously you told us he's competitive, he's relentless and he's cheeky, but you know, just try and give us an image of that and a lot, and how you'd want him to be remembered and how you think he'd want to be remembered.
He gives everybody time. Whoever you are, whoever you stand up to be or what you're not, he will always give you time. And I think that's one of the things. He would always spend time with somebody. He would never just go, I'm too big for you. He was always there for people. And he's one of these guys that if you had a problem or you needed somebody to come and help you, he'd be the first guy you would phone, the first guy to turn up at your door. We used the legend easily sometimes, but he just was a man that enjoyed helping people, enjoyed a laugh, and he wanted people to have a good time. If somebody wasn't at a good time, he'd go and sit with them and understand why they're not having a good time. You know, he was one of these guys that just enjoyed the moment and lived every day as if it was his last.
Did he ever speak to you about the end? Did he ever say, obviously, at some point, this is going to happen? And if so, did he say, fuck's sake, Kenny, don't cry, have a wee dram for me? Like, what was his final thoughts? Because I imagine if he was only given a couple of years to live and he's absolutely just, you know, beat that and he showed his kind of willing. Did you have those conversations and what did he say?
Do you know, when we did his first dinner in Battersea, and I said, we're going to do this dinner for you, because I know nobody will turn up. I said, no, we'll do this dinner. And we did, I think within 3 months, we raised, well, we had 1,400 people at this dinner, and he raised about 850,000. And that was a moment for him. He realised that he could make an impact in this disease, because the warmth for them, and this was a dinner in London, it wasn't a dinner in Scotland or anyone else. And I think the amazing thing that Doddy's done, even though he wore tartan every minute of the day, you know, he's recognised all over the world. And the amount of English fans, Welsh fans, Irish fans, Kiwis, all supported him through this journey. But I've now forgotten the question, Haskell.
So, I meant what he must have talked to you. He must have said, "Kenny, look, when this ends, you know, like, I know, like I've always said, if I go, you know, I don't really want people to say things that weren't true. I'd quite like someone to stand at my feet and go, listen, he was a bit of a dickhead. Some people liked him, some people didn't. You know, let's...
And I'll tell it to your face.
We'll be queuing up for that, everyone house, does. Don't worry.
Jesus Christ.
And I'd say everyone have a bit of a party. Let's all get pissed up. Let's celebrate it. Let's move on. When you know you're on a ticking clock, I just wondered whether he ever sat down and said, Kenny, look, when I do go, I don't want this to be a miserable affair. I want you to carry on. Was there any of that conversation happen?
No, we never really... We talked... I think the interesting thing for me was, because of M&D, your body starts to slow down, and he was never going to have a tube in his mouth or a pipe let him to breathe. And he said no to the tube into his stomach would feed him, because he said, no, if I can't eat, I don't want to be here. So as he was, people were saying, you should get these things done, you should get the tube in your side... he was, no, that's not happening. I'll know when I'm ready to go. And I think he never ever talked about dying. He just talked about being positive. And one thing he'd want us to do is have a laugh. You know, he doesn't want us to, you know, I think he'll be over the moon. I mean, he must look down and be so proud of the amount of people have come out and spoke so highly about him. But they probably have said that before anyway. But I think for him, he took day by day. He never once said to me, I mean, I remember it's not, Kathy said once, because he's doing my head in so much, I might take him to Switzerland. which I was like, really? Really?
What but, was he doing?
Chloe tried to take me to Switzerland the other day. I was only asleep, Kenny. I woke up on a plane. She goes, shh, shh.
What was he doing to drive her to that point?
Doddy's stubborn, right? He's very stubborn, and if he doesn't want to do something, he will not do it. And if he is wanting to do something, he'll achieve his goals. That's one thing I'd say as a character. He was a stubborn bloke. You know, I spoke to Gary Armstrong yesterday, and he's his big mate. And one thing Gary said to him as soon as it all came out, he said, listen, Doddy's got this long road into his farm. And he said, listen, see all those potholes you've got? Don't you think I'm filling them in for you going up and down there with your wheelchair? You know, so there was a lot of banter. And Doddy wanted to laugh about it. He didn't want to... You know, he wanted to have fun. He wanted to take the mickey out of it. But there was also that huge serious side to Doddy about trying to find this cure and make an impact, and which he has. He's made an impact in many people's lives, so he's not even met them. He made an impact, especially in the M&D world.
Kenny, I was thinking if you want to have a laugh at the funeral, just lift your kilt up and let everyone see, and that'll bet everyone will be pissing themselves next to the graveside, so it should be all right.
I'll try that, yeah. That's a good... Yeah. How's your chipolata anyway?
Yeah, it's good. The little button mushroom's doing well, Chief. It's doing
good, lad.
Doing well.
Good, lad. You see, you got a little one in the way. You've got a little one.
I have. It works. To look at it, you never would have guessed it, yeah, but it absolutely does. One shot, one goal.
Only in a Doddy Weir obit would we be talking about your button mushrooms. The thing I wanted to touch on, Kenny, was his presence amongst his peers, because I did a couple of bits with him on Sky, and I go back to the fact that, Christ, you didn't want to get it wrong around him. I also was lucky enough to have a couple of weekends playing in the Legends Golf at Loch Lomond, where they raised a lot of money for Sparks. And what was always fascinating about that is it was a collection of the great and good. So Jeremy Guscott, Paul Wallace, Ian Evans, John Bentley, etc. would come. But Doddy was always the legend amongst the legends. Now, it obviously helps if you're 6'7", etc. But he had so much sort of camaraderie around him and so much energy that he gave to a room. I just wonder whether that sort of equates with how you remember him. He just made things happen. You wanted to be in the room when he was on fire, and that is amongst his peers and those that he played at the very highest level with.
Yeah, I mean, he had that aura about him. You know, he had that sort of, if you're around Doddy, something was going to happen.
Yeah.
Sometimes bad, right? But in general, he's pretty good. And when I first started helping him out at the foundation, he said, right, well, it's a dial change, Kenny. We're going to have a proper dial change. And we want to make things happen. And that was him. You know, he was that character. He didn't want to sit back. He didn't watch other people do it. He'd do it himself. You know, if he couldn't do it, he'd tell me to do it or tell somebody else to do it. But he definitely was that character that you like to be around because he fills your heart with fun. Yeah? And, you know, yesterday, I haven't felt this sort of soreness for a long, long time. Probably since I lost my dad or my cousins. And it's quite a hard thing to talk about when somebody's made that much impact in your life and you've enjoyed being around them. Even just 2 weeks ago, I went to his house and he obviously struggled to speak, but just being in the presence of him and him laughing at the things that you say, or, you know, he'd turn around and go and shake his head knowing that that's wrong. And you're right, he did pick you up and he was great at it, and it kept your feet in the ground.
Extraordinarily inspirational in all he did. Give us your memories of him as a player and a trainer and a teammate and a sort of, you know, a man in his boots.
He was never the best trainer in the world. Doddy was a fit boy, but if he could get out of training, he would get out of it. But I remember when I thought, I mean, 6'7", and he's probably about 15 stone when he played for Scotland, you know. They just threw him up in the line out. But he became more than that, you know, he started putting the weight on. And I think because he was an amateur rugby player and they went professional, when him and Gary went to Newcastle, and that's where you really saw Doddy becoming a proper international rugby player, because he got bigger and his chest was, but he started to train because he had to train. He wasn't just going on the farm. I've just worked the whole days in the farm and sat in the tractor. But he was natural strength. He was a farmer, so he had natural strength. But he was a great line-out jumper, but also carried well and physical. He wasn't scared to put a hit in. And in the days when he played, you could have a proper fight, and he'd be in the middle of it. He'd be setting it up, and he'd be trying to finish it. And him and Martin Johnson had many good dings. And if you speak to Martin about him, you know, he was a hard man. Even though he was only maybe at the end, he was maybe only 17, 18 stone. He was one of these guys, you look in the change room, and you just, if Doddy was in the change room, there was something good about it. There was just a feeling that, you know, Doddy's playing, you know, because he had played for Scotland when he was 19 in the 1991 World Cup, I think. So he played a year before I did. So he was this young star, everybody talking about, but he wasn't like a big second row. He was, you know, as Bill McLaren said, he ran like a giraffe. I think Newcastle days were his best days. You know, great days at Melrose, but I think you saw the best of him. And then the Lions, just so unlucky with that horrible injury he got.
Was he angry about it? Did he find that easy to park? Because, I mean, a lot of people would have said he would have started alongside Johnson if he'd stayed fit.
Yeah, but if you watch him, if you watch the video when he was told, yeah, well, fair enough.
Yeah,
just that was his attitude. He just went, I'll get on with it. I'll just get it. How long will it be? Oh, will that be all right next week? No. How long are you out for? Oh, a couple of months. It's been a good tour so far. That was the way his mindset was. He just got over things very quickly and moved on. And I think I wouldn't say he got over M&D, but he certainly put everything into it and made an impact on the disease. And, you know, he'll never, ever be forgotten.
You are absolutely bang on that. He was absolutely one of a kind, incredibly brave and inspirational, and has given a lot of people a lot of joy, not only as a player, but in the way that he sort of entertained us all. And hopefully, if people are watching and listening and you can find your way to popping, you know, a pound in the pot of the My Name's Doddy Foundation, obviously the work continues and we'll go on and on and on from here. How are you? Oh boy, because you've had a tough couple of months, haven't you?
I've had a tough couple of months, prostate cancer, but I'm all right now. I'm very lucky to, I sort of managed to stumble across it about February. Well, I actually stumbled.
You lost your car keys out there, did you, or something? Lost the remote again.
No, I'm just glad to get it back.
Yes, that's what I was saying. Oh, it happens, mate.
Hold the upper watch.
Gabby left her wedding ring out there again. Yeah,
Hask every time. We're trying to talk about some getting men checked.
Well, no, because that's how Kenny... Like, I know. Kenny, honestly, Kenny's relentlessly giving me shit for the time, but wore a smile on my face since I've known him. But when I saw the news... I was sitting there and I was like, flash that, you know, that I've had prostate cancer. I was like, fucking hell, you kept that quiet. Rang him straight up. I was like, you're right. I was like, yeah. Because you just, it is terrifying in that period of time, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I was 2020 December. I got a random test and the guy said, your prostate's a bit high. Don't worry about it. So the surgeon, my surgeon sort of said, well, we'll just check it. It was fine. Well, it was a bit high. And he said he wasn't worried, but as weeks went on, he said he was worried. He just didn't want to tell me because it was Christmas time. And then the following year, I'd got another couple of tests and it had gone, the PSA levels had gone high. So he said, look, we need to get it out. So the operation is quite invasive. So they stab you about six times in the stomach to get it out. And it's right to the bottom of your core. So it's quite an invasive operation. It took me about 3 to 4 months to recover properly. And it does make you think, because it's one of the biggest killers for men. And it's one of these cancers, if you don't go looking for it and it finds you, it's probably too late.
Shit. God, well done. You. Has that changed your perspective on everything at all? I mean, obviously, you know, coupled with your old mate that we've been talking about, or is it just sort of, wow, cleared that hurdle, let's crack on?
Well, it's been tough because Tom Smith also passed away this year. So we've had two great rugby players and another different sort of legend to the game. And we are at that stage in our life where diseases, divorces and deaths, and there's no more stag weekends or 30ths. They're well gone. 60ths now, 50ths. But so this year's been quite tough for... when I went to Tom's funeral, I knew my prostate was not right. And just thinking that Tom was the one who was a bit unlucky. He had bowel cancer. But, you know, as we get older, we've got to get tested. We've got to look after ourselves, because just getting a simple test can save your life.
Shit. Very strong messaging. We would love at some point to have a sit down with the first couple of rugby when Gabby's back from doing the round ball game. It'd be great fun to chew the fat with both of you. But what's keeping you busy at the moment? You're obviously down at Wasps. Is your boy still playing at Wasps?
Midlands now.
Midlands? What does that mean?
Yeah, because Wasps don't have academy anymore. So
that would be right. Yeah, so yeah. What does that mean, Midlands? Just in the Midlands Academy?
So that means it's the Wasps Academy, but he's in that, it's now called the Midlands Academy.
Right.
He's also in England under-18s, which is very...
I was going to ask you about that. Is that are you saying that with a smile, or are you trying to drag him north of the border?
Well, I mean, at the moment, that's the best thing for him. You know, he's enjoying his rugby and... you know, see what happens. But if he, you know, it's the main thing is to enjoy it, and that's what he's doing. But Wasps is sad at the moment. But there is a team working behind the scenes.
I feel like we need to cheer you up, Kenny. I mean,
no,
Jesus! I feel like we might have to have an intervention. I mean, you know, I'm not sure I want to be friends with you because you've had a nightmare situation. I'll be in the fucking ground.
My son's playing for England.
Everyone's dying. Everyone's got cancer. You're like, this is a nightmare. Well, I mean, what do we need to take him out for a night out or something? Do you want to come? Yeah. Can we get you in the show?
It'll be our Christmas party.
Christmas party. Yeah. No, I'm good. It's been quite weird the last 24 hours. You sort of like this morning. I did a radio, I did a TV, and I struggled to hold myself together because of the emotions, and I feel a bit more, as Doddy would say, pull yourself together, you big idiot. Yeah. Well, so I think I've just been a bit more serious today than normal, because it's been quite hard. You know, I've generally, the amount of people have contacted me about meeting Doddy once and the impact he'd left in their lives. So when you lose somebody like that, it's quite hard, isn't it? You just sort of... You get a bit serious, but I'm still quite funny.
Okay, because I'm a bit worried, because I was going to fly to Dubai tomorrow, but I feel like I might have to come round and make sure you're
all right. Seriously, I'm not desperate for you. Fly to Dubai.
Wait, trying to improve the situation, not make it worse.
Switzerland.
I could push you over the edge. But, I mean, I'd just go back to some of the answer to Scotland. That was, when you gave that answer, it was very much like almost like a media answer, but I can imagine you've got like a pen and you're putting it in your leg going, that's the best for him now. It's, you know, his age group. When you're like, cause have you said to him, listen, son, over my dead body, you're fucking playing for England? Or have you just said, look,
no,
play around
could,
now.
Could go to Wales, of course.
Oh, yeah, could go to Wales.
Yeah. If you go to Wales, I would do that next.
Would you be actually, yeah. No, genuinely, because I wonder about, would you actually be asked, as long as he was happy and playing rugby, would you really care?
Listen, I'd love him to play for Scotland, but it's 25 grand a game, isn't it? No,
yeah, that's
I'd love him to play for Scotland.
Oh, yeah.
I'd love him to play for Scotland, but you know, when you'd live down here, so hard to be up there for sessions, and you're out of sight, out of mind a little bit. Yeah. So his best pathway is to play for England, and you know, who knows what's going to happen. If he's good enough, he's good enough. If he's not, he's going to play for Wales.
By the way, do you want me to stop by on the way? Do you want me to stop by on the way home and give you a hug? Would you like that?
Tonight.
Well, I mean, I probably can nip round tonight, or you know, I'll come round at some point.
Whereabouts, sorry? Let's, when you go to Dubai, come back rested, and we'll have a lunch.
Well, I'd like that.
Come round,
we do that.
Come round with your little one.
Because I've never been to Chateau Logan, because apparently it's so.
Well, your mum's been. Your mum's been.
Fucking hell!
Your mum stole all my logs.
I better check on her. Jesus, she'll be in the ground if she's been hanging out with you.
What I love about this, Kenny, is just bringing you in to reminisce about Doddy, and this is the sort of shit he'd have loved, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Just sort of arsing about and
yeah.
Listen, good on you. Will you look after yourself? You know, make sure that you're doing the right thing.
I'm in good form, boys, and very lucky. And thanks for your support to Doddy. It means a lot to us in the foundation, and.
Yeah, good on you. We'll stick the right links in the right places so people can click and eat. And in the meantime, look after yourself. We'd love to catch up properly soon. Love to the family. And thanks so much for swinging by.
Thank you, Kenny. Love you, mate.
Cheers, cheers. And there he goes. As we so often say, what a testimony to a mate whilst encapsulating the legend as well.
Yes. I mean, I just think, I know some people get very sensitive around when someone passes away. And of course, that's right. But also, you've got to celebrate that person for what they were. Like when death comes, in my opinion, you kind of end up suddenly changing the dynamic of how it would be. And you know, if he was there, he would have been laughing and having a joke about it. And you know, you've got to be respectful of others. But I think Kenny summed it up beautifully. He is obviously a legend of the game. We do use it very flippantly. Everyone's a legend, this legend, mate. But actually, he was. And the mark of any good man, it's not what the media say or the fans say. It's what your peers say, what your friends say, what your family says about you, and everyone's just come out raving about him. And Kenny himself, you know, to have that scare and to have that character, you know, I love Kenny's laugh, always makes me laugh. You know, I had him for so many times that that's weird. Might have done. Very close team we were. You know, I spent a lot of time with Kenny at Wasps, and obviously he's very young. I used to watch Wasps as a fan. He was always utterly brilliant, always made me laugh.
Banging over the goals at QPR.
Yeah, just wicked. I couldn't love him anymore. He's such a good guy.
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? As we wrap up this show, we've spent half of it talking about Eddie out, England in the doldrums, Wayne Pivac time to go. And then you bring it round to celebrating someone like Doddy Weir. And you sort of remember that actually, in the grand scheme of things, rugby is a sport that we love on a Saturday, but it gives us more characters than any other. And perhaps you just try and keep it between the 40 and 60 percentile rather than the 10 and 90. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, we'll talk about it another show, but I did my first stand-up thing the other day, right? And I was a bit nervous before it. And Chloe went, oh, for fuck's sake, James, you're standing up and talking in front of a room. There's people dying in Ukraine. Just relax. And I was like, yeah, you're probably right. I know everyone gets passionate about sport, but we're lucky that the biggest concern we've got is whether England... beat South Africa, and who's going to be a coach when other people are faced with many more challenges. I know you can only deal with the context you experience, but ultimately it's a game, you know, and it's what you do between life and death which ultimately matters, not what you do on a weekend. And someone like to go and dedicate his life to trying to raise that amount of money, you know, because it'd be so easy to sit there feeling sorry for yourself as you watch your body disintegrate and your mind's still active and you can't perform. But to raise over £8 million in research and to start that journey to put M&D on the map, I think it's brilliant. And I think for anyone listening to this pod, it's always just good. Have a little wake-up call.
Yeah.
Just have a look at yourself and go, remember, do you know what? Fucking life could be way worse.
Yeah.
And you should just always see what you're doing every day. Are you better today than you were yesterday? The answer is yes, you're cracking it. If it's not, you need a long, hard look at yourself. Yeah.
Well said. Let's hope that the old ticker goes up for My Name's Doddy Foundation. If you're able to pop the price of a cup of coffee into the My Name's Doddy Foundation, that would be an amazing thing to do. It feels a bit churlish to wrap up the show by mentioning our Christmas merch, but if you've got loads of cash and you want to do Doddy first and foremost, that is the most important thing. Let's do Doddy first. And if you want to buy a hoodie, goodbadrugby.com. Hoodies, t-shirts, caps and mini rugby balls. Seems a bit frivolous.
But it's also great merch. Like, it's frivolous, but we need some, you know, we need Christmas
presents.
You know what?
Sod the merch. Stick your money in Doddy's Foundation. Yeah. That is by far and away more important. We would like to nod, or give a nod, to our shirt of the week, which those of you watching will see behind me. For those of you on audio, it's a fairly flamboyant blend of purple and pink, and it is the Akuma Beavers shirt. Which
it's actually a beaver.
It's a beaver.
I thought Akuma Beaver was something you got a bit of a dodgy partner.
Right.
Put it in an Akuma Beaver, you never get it back. Now I realise what it is.
The shirt belongs to our very own Tommy Rockets, who many of you will have seen in action in our Play Together, Stay Together campaign. He absolutely ripped it up when we went down to, what club was it? Aylesbury Rugby Club a few weeks ago. I can't remember what I did yesterday.
Yeah.
You and Tins had your game and Tommy Rockets was absolutely brilliant. But he is now out in Dubai playing for the Akuma Beavers, who are an Invitational Sevens team that this week are in Dubai playing, and since forming in 2016 have managed to raise over £50,000 for the Shooting Star Children's Hospices. Tommy Rockets, you ledge, you. They have set up a Just Giving page, so if, and now is the time to give, is it not? Let's do Doddy first of all. If you've got a spare couple of quid and you'd like to put that into the Akuma Beavers Shooting Star Children Hospice Fund, there is a Just Giving page. Please search for Akuma Beavers in the Just Giving search bar. Don't search for beavers in your search bar, because that'll bring you something very different.
Equally beneficial. But
Tommy Rockets is raising money for a very good cause. Tis the season to give. Hopefully there's a pound or two we can contribute to both of those. Don't forget our lock-in show, which we will record in a moment or two. We're going to talk conspiracy theories, apparently.
Nicknames, conspiracy theories, Hancock, and Tins.
And Tins. That'll come together in a curious fashion, as per normal. Untold stories, behind-the-scenes access, and more of Hask. Apparently the Lord and myself will clip in occasionally. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts. It's an addition to the freebie. If you love what we do and you fancy a little extra in your earballs, go click. If not, don't worry about it. Hell of a roller coaster this week. I think that sort of sums up rugby in general at the moment. But we have been the good, the bad, and the rugby. We'll see you again next week. The show is produced by Shara Kilgallen and Ollie Hunter. The Good, the Bad, and the Rugby is a Folding Pocket production. Look after yourselves. Pounds in the pot, please. See you next week.
You have been listening to The Good, The Bad and The Rugby. I hope you enjoyed it. But if you didn't, well, you didn't pay anything for it. So what exactly is your problem?